We're in Deuteronomy chapter number 25, ready to start in verse number 17. We have a multitude of topics in this book because it is Moses' final address to the Israelites before he dies, before they go into the Promised Land. So he's trying to review everything that he's been teaching them from God for the past 40 years. Verse number 17, he passes on something from God about future judgment against the people known as the Amalekites. This is what it says, verse 17. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you came out of Egypt, how he attacked you on the way when you were faint and weary and cut off your tail, those who were lagging behind you, and he did not fear God. So right at the very beginning of the Exodus, before they'd arrived at Mount Sinai, these, quote, escaped slaves, end quote, were targeted by the Amalekites for recapture. The Amalekites had, well, they were actually related to the Israelites distantly. They are a descendant of Esau. And they started out being traders. They buy material and goods at one place and transport them and then sell them at another place, buy things there, and then go to another place and sell and buy. And so they were going all over the place, and they were well known for that. But at some point before the Exodus, they had really seen a great profit margin in dealing in slaves. And so when they saw hundreds of thousands of men, plus all their families, out there in the Sinai at this time, having recently left Egypt, they saw here the means of great profit to recapture these slaves and either sell them back to the Egyptians or sell them elsewhere in the Middle East. And so they attacked them. They basically waited and grabbed a hold of the stragglers to begin with. And Joshua was involved in fighting them off. At the time, God said, that will not be forgotten. Mark it down. This cannot be allowed to continue in this world, in this community. The Amalekites and their kidnapping ideals, because basically they'd turned into slavers, human traffickers. That is a capital crime. And so God basically pronounced a death penalty upon the Amalekites at that time to be carried out at a later date. And so here is Moses reminding them of that. Verse 19, therefore, when he who is your God has given you rest from all your enemies around you in the land that he who is your God is giving you for an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget. So this is just a reminder. Once you get settled in the land, you're supposed to get rid of the Amalekite slavers. Now, they don't. They keep postponing it. Amalekites keep causing trouble for generations afterward. King Saul, several hundred years after this, was supposed to carry out this capital punishment penalty against the Amalekites. He doesn't get it done properly. David tries to clean up King Saul's failure, but can't quite get it done. Until finally, in the book of Esther, Haman the Agagite is a direct descendant of King Agag of the Amalekites from King Saul's day. And you know what happens in the book of Esther. Haman the Agagite tries to annihilate all the Jews of the world. All the Jews living in the Persian Empire, which was pretty much all the Jews of the world. And all of that happens in the book of Esther because this penalty was not carried out at its earliest possible chance. So just be aware that failure to comply with God's directives can cause big problems farther down the line. Chapter 26, verse 1, change of topic. When you come into the land that he who is your God is giving you for an inheritance and have taken possession of it and live in it. So that's not very far out. Moses is making this address on the first day of the 11th month of the 40th year of the Exodus. The Israelis will move into the promised land in a matter of months. And then they will plant their first crops in the fall of the 41st year of the Exodus, the first year that they're in the promised land. And so they will harvest in the spring and summer of the 42nd year of the Exodus, the second year that they're in the promised land. So that's not too terribly far away. So verse 2, you shall take some of the fruit of all the fruit of the ground which you harvest from your land that he who is your God is giving you, and you shall put it in a basket. So this is a representative sample of the first harvest. And you shall go to the place that he who is your God shall choose to make his name to dwell there. That is a reference to the tabernacle at this time. And the tabernacle in that second year of the living in the promised land, I believe, was located at Shechem, or at the area where the blessing and curse ceremony took place, although it may have already been moved to Shiloh. So anyway, you're going to take that there. Verse 3, you shall go to the priest who is in office at that time and say to him, I declare today to he who is your God that I have come into the land that he who is swore to our fathers to give us. And then the priest shall take the basket from your hand and set it down before the altar of he who is your God. Now, this is going to be very important the very first time that it happens, because it is the premier thank you to God for keeping his promises. But it becomes the model of attitude for every year when the Jewish people bring their tithes at the Feast of Tabernacles to thank God for another year of blessing. And so we have the priest that is key in this, receiving this gift of thanksgiving, the tithe, from a Jewish person, an Israeli, on behalf of God. Verse number 5, you shall make response before he who is your God. And then they're supposed to remember their history. And this is the memory aspect. A wandering Aramean was my father. Now, an Aramean means an inhabitant of Aram. And the Aram we have in mind here is Ur of the Chaldees, where Abraham started out from, where we have Isaac get his wife from, and where Jacob goes and get his wife from. And so all three of them, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, would have been thought of as Aramean. So a wandering Aramean, meaning an Aramean that does not have a permanent home. And what happens? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob live in the promised land area, but it is only promised to them. It is not given to them. And then what happens next in the little memory here. He went down into Egypt and sojourned there, few in number. Well, that's the story of Jacob, isn't it? Jacob eventually goes down to Egypt, and he's only got 72 names in his family tree, men in his family tree at that time. So there are very few, but they go down to live at Egypt as sojourners. It's not their land. And there he became a nation, great, mighty, and populous. And so Jacob, whose other name was Israel, goes from being the head of a family to the head of a nation, an ethnic group, named the Israelis. And the Israelis end up very numerous. And what happens next? Verse 6, "And the Egyptians treated us harshly and humiliated us and laid on us hard labor." So what's happening here is in the ceremony of the tithe giving, it is a recalling of history. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Israel and Egypt, the bondage. What comes next? The Exodus. Verse 7, "Then we cried to He who is the God of our fathers, and He who has heard our voice, saw our affliction, our toil, our oppression, and He who has brought us up out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, with great deeds of terror, with signs and wonders." So that's the Exodus. And then the next thing, which they have not yet experienced but are about to, needs to be part of the memory whenever the tithes are given each year, but especially in the giving of the very first tithes. Verse 9, "And He brought us into this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey," a very prosperous land. "And behold, now I bring the first of the fruit of the ground which you, our O He who is, have given me." So, you kept your promises, God. So here I am bringing back my tithe, the first part of the produce from this land. And then Moses says, "You shall set it down before He who is your God and worship before He who is your God." So celebrate and worship. Verse 11 says, "You shall rejoice in all the good that He who is your God has given to you and to your house, you and the Levite and the sojourner who is among you." And we've talked about this. When the tithe is brought to the place of worship, the tabernacle to begin with, later it'll be the temple. When that tithe is brought, it's brought during the Feast of Tabernacles. And the Feast of Tabernacles is set aside for an 8-day-long party. It begins with a day of worship and rest. It ends with a day of worship and rest. But in between, it's all celebration. And they eat from their tithe. It's part of the party supplies. And because it's a big party, they're supposed to invite their local Levites in. Because remember, the Levites live in all the different communities, in all the different tribal regions. That's the way it's going to be. So invite your local Levites to come enjoy your family's party. I'm picturing the Levites probably went around to different families throughout the 7 days, the 8 days of the Feast of Tabernacle, because they would have known a lot of different families that they helped in their Levitical work. But also the sojourner. We've talked about sojourners several times in the last several sessions. Sojourners were non-Israelis living in the land of Israel. Sometimes they were agricultural workers just looking for work. Other times they were people escaping problems elsewhere. Sometimes they were looking to Israel as the possibility of being their adopted country. Maybe they were thinking about converting to the true faith. So these sojourners, they didn't own property. They worked for other people. And so the Israelis were reminded, invite them to your party. Invite them to the Feast of Tabernacles to enjoy the blessings of this time period. Verse number 12. We're still on the same topic, just have a slight shift in it. Verse 12. When you have finished paying all the tithe of your produce in the third year, which is the year of tithing, giving it to the Levite, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, so that they may eat within your towns and be filled. Now, this can be confusing because of the wording here and because of some of the commentators not understanding the wording here. This is the best way I think I can explain it, having gleaned all the information from other places and putting it together. We understand that the Jewish people lived by a seven-year cycle. They actually lived by a 49-year larger cycle, but let's just talk about the sabbatical cycle. That sabbatical cycle involved 6 years of work followed by a seventh year of rest. During the 6 years of work, Feast of Tabernacles would come around and they would pay their tithe at the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, in years 1 and 2 and 4 and 5, so the majority of the years, they would take the full tithe of that year's produce to the place of worship. Tabernacle to begin with, temple later. They would use a small portion of that for the party, for the 8 days of the Feast of Tabernacles, celebrating. Everything that was left of the tithe at that point was then handed over to the Levites, and by them the priests, to be used as their pay, as their support for the rest of the year, or the coming year. And then they'd go home. In year 3, and that's what the 3 here is about, in the year of the tithe, the third year of the tithe. So in year 3 and the other multiple, 6. So in year 3 and 6, they would keep their tithe locally. They would give it to their local Levites and to their local priests. Because remember, the Levites and the priests were scattered throughout the 12 tribes. Now they would take a small portion, and they'd have some clue as to how much they would need for this, but in year 3 and 6, they would take a small portion of their tithe to the place of worship and have their party. And anything that was left over, they'd give to the priests and the Levites. But in year 3 and 6, that's what we're talking about here. The local storehouses would be filled up with the tithe. And what would be that tithe's use? Well, it would be used for the Levites and the priests, but also sojourners that fell on hard times would be supported out of that tithe. And the fatherless, that's the orphans, would be supported out of their tithes as needed. And the widows, that's our group of three, sojourner, fatherless, and widow, that are powerless, are without means of supporting themselves. So they would be supported out of the local storehouses as needed. Now, once you've done that, then we come to verse 13. Then you shall say before He who is your God, I have removed the sacred portion out of my house, and moreover, I have given it to the Levite, the sojourner, and the fatherless, and the widow, according to all your commandment that you have commanded me. I have not transgressed in any of your commandments. So this is, again, it's Feast of Tabernacles time. Pretty much you've wrapped up the tithing period, you've wrapped up the feasting period, and you're now saying, I have done what you asked me to do, Lord. I have tithed each year. In year 3 and 6, I kept those tithes locally to make sure everybody is taken care of, that's supposed to be taken care of by those tithes. And now I want you to understand I have done everything I can to stick with the rules. Now, here's some of the specifics related to that tithe. I have not eaten of the tithe while I was mourning. So the only time that they ever ate from the tithe was during the Feast of Tabernacles. And it would have been inappropriate to eat the tithes while you were mourning over the death of a loved one. The reality was, more than likely, if you were mourning over a death of a loved one, you were unclean and would not have attended the Feast of Tabernacles in person. You'd still send your tithe, but you personally would not go. Or removed any of it while I was unclean. So again, if something had happened to make you unclean, then you wouldn't be at the Feast of Tabernacles, and so you wouldn't be eating of the tithe. Or offered any of it to the dead. Now, many of the rules that the Israelis were given were in direct response to what the Canaanites had been doing. And worship of the dead, or paying tribute and honor to the dead, was part of their culture. And the Israelis were told, don't practice that. And so giving food to the dead was one of the things the Canaanites had been doing. And so here, at the end of this whole process, the righteous Jew says, the righteous Israeli says, I didn't use any of the tithes in showing worship toward the dead. I have obeyed the voice of He who is my God. I have done according to all that you've commanded me. So I've kept your covenant. That's effectively what a person is saying here at the end of the agricultural cycle, because Feast of Tabernacles coming in the seventh month was the beginning of the next cycle. So it's the transition moment. So I have done everything in the last cycle according to your rules, and so I want you to bless me in this coming cycle. That's verse 15. Look down from your holy habitation, from heaven, and bless your people Israel and the ground that you've given us, as you swore to our fathers, a land of milk, a land flowing with milk and honey. So effectively asking God, please give us another good year ahead of us. Because typically after the seventh month, they would start working the ground to get it ready to be seeded with the next grain crops. Verse 16. This day, He who is your God commands you to do these statutes and rules. You shall therefore be careful to do them with all your heart, with all your soul. Now, this is where Moses is starting to wrap up his review material. So he says, you've heard all this. All of this came from God. You need to be doing it with 100% of your being. Verse 17. You have declared today that He who is your God, and that you will walk in His ways and keep His statutes and His commandments and His rules and will obey His voice. So this is Moses making it clear. You guys are making the commitment. I'm not making it on your behalf. You're making the commitment that you will follow all of this stuff. Verse 18, and He who has declared today that you are a people for His treasured possession as He has promised you. So a covenant involves a relationship commitment. So the people are saying to God, you are our God. We will keep your covenant rules. God says to the people, you are my special people. You are my segula. Segula is the Hebrew word for treasured possession here. Best way to understand it is the most valuable thing you have. If your house is on fire and you can only run in and grab one thing, that's your segula. That's your most prized possession. So Israel is God's most prized possession. And so he's promised this to you, and that you will keep all his commandments, and that he will set you in praise and in fame and in honor high above all nations that he has made, and that you shall be a people holy to he who is your God, as he promised. So the covenant is being all wrapped up together here, very clearly. God will have Israel as his people. He'll have a tight, intimate relationship with them that he doesn't have with all the other ethnic groups that are out there. He still cares about those other ethnic groups, but this relationship is special. And the Israelis, in return, need to do everything God's way. That's the relationship. That's what will make them holy. Holy is a fancy English word that we pretty much only use in church. It has the idea of being set aside for a specific purpose. So the Israeli people are going to be set aside only for God. That's what they're committing to. Now, sadly, that is not what will transpire as history moves forward. And something is going to be done next to try to, first of all, help them keep their commitment, but secondly, to be used as evidence against them when they don't keep that commitment. And so I want you to mark your place for Deuteronomy chapter 27 and the next time we get in to God's Word.